You're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Merritt Island, Melbourne, Titusville, and the Beaches, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Vieira, 94.7 FM, and W264AS, Melbourne, and Palm Bay, 100.7 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here on in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We're on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. Today's show was supposed to have our good friend Marion Moore, but she's not here. She's en route. She's flying. She's coming home. So we want to thank her for sponsoring our show today for the Brevard Homeless Coalition. We have a packed studio. My co-host Ellen is here, Ellen Little. She's my right arm behind the scenes. And Paul is here. He's running our board. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for always showing up and running the board for us. You know,
well, it's my pleasure.
Sometimes we always tell people when to do something that's not right. But I want to tell you that everything you do for our show is right.
Well, thank you very much.
My father used to say sometimes a man could do 99% good things and one wrong thing. And you always hear about the wrong, but you never hear about the right.
Right.
So here, you know,
I still do the wrong occasionally. I'm working on it. Not perfect yet.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So, Ellen, we have a really great show today. Our good friend Stanley Breeze is here, and he's the director of community services for Eckerd Connects. He's a friend of our show. We love everything he's doing to help our community. And we're just grateful that he's back on this fun, unscripted, a very educational and quite informative show.
Glad to be back.
Yes, thank you. And then we have Susan Kowalski. Susan is here. She is going to be talking later. She is with the
Brevard Reentry Task Force. I'm the chair.
Yeah, we have to make sure we said the right thing why people are here, because we have a packed studio. And then we also have Angela Bozard is here. And Angela is a community specialist with Volunteer for America. But today she is here with the Brevard Homeless Coalition.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow, what a great show. I can feel it in my bones, you know, that we're going to have a good show. And I was telling you, Ellen, you know, sometimes I do believe in divine intervention, right? And so I'm at the gas station this morning, and two young fellas are behind me pumping their gas. And I'm about to leave because there was another fella that pulled up, and he was using some foul language. And I said, you know, the world is full up of so much hate these days and people who judge each other and all that. I'm going to take off. But the one fella in the car who was next to me, he says, hey, lady, do you have a couple of bucks? And I contemplated saying, oh, maybe you should go get a job. And then I'm like, no, I'm not going to judge. So I knew I had a $5 bill in my front seat. And so I gave him the $5. But I noticed that there were clothing in the car. The two fellas... they looked like they needed some help. And the one guy says, well, we're headed to the courthouse. So right away, I said to myself, this is my show right here. We need to show compassion. We need to have love in our hearts at all time. We need to be able to help if the good Lord has blessed us to help others. And also, the situation in the car tells me that these fellas need some help and they need hope. And so I feel like I did that today. And so I figured that's going to set the tone for our show today. Right?
Yes.
And I feel good about myself given that little $5. I could go have a cup of coffee with that, right? But somebody else does. So, and also, we all saw this weekend what happened in New Zealand. And I just want to say, you know, at some point, all of us have the responsibility to understand that freedom of speech does come with a responsibility to use nice words and be calm and understand that we're all created differently. But at the end of the day, we all want to be loved and appreciated. It doesn't matter what faith you practice, the color of your skin, your race, where you live. It really doesn't matter. At the end of life, when we leave this planet, I think we all want to leave a good footprint behind and make a difference. Nobody's perfect. And every single day, we learn something new. Every Monday, when we leave our show, we learn something new as well. And I think it's up to us who have that gift of consciousness. You know, I always say that not everyone is blessed to understand how great it is that you have these wonderful senses, the sense to feel and hear and touch and give back and think and breathe. And we should show appreciation for that. But we also need to use this wonderful gift that God gave us, our bodies, to help other people and make America and the world a kinder, more gentle and mindful place. So with that happy note, we're going to start our show today.
We are going to start, and I'm going to sign off this Facebook Live.
Yeah.
Tune in, everybody.
And I think you should show Stanley one more time, looking so handsome there with us, with all the ladies.
I got to look
Susan.
Presentable.
Hello. Okay, tune in.
So we're talking about multiple social issues today on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And some of the issues we're going to be talking about today is the homeless crisis, not just in Brevard, but all over the United States. The opioid use and the re-entry back into society, and how difficult that is sometimes. And we all know that, you know what, we always say vote, right? Voting, we have to vote people in power. That makes a difference in Tallahassee or in Washington, D.C. But sometimes it not only comes down to voting, it comes down to the foundation of a community, of society, and the institutions that we hold near and dear, like, you know, public school, the prison system, the courts, whatever it is that are affecting people's life, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're going to start off by asking Angela Bozo to tell us a little bit about herself and your connection to Brevard Homeless Coalition.
Okay. Well, I've been a substance abuse counselor here in Brevard County for just about 18 years. I started in 2001. And during that time, I have worked inpatient treatment, outpatient treatment, drug education, and also methadone maintenance. And I have watched the opioid crisis occur in real time from the beginning back in 2001. So I've seen quite a bit as far as substance abuse here in Brevard County. And then I spent a couple of years up in North Carolina, where I'm also a certified substance abuse counselor. And it's not just here. It is a nationwide crisis.
Sounds like you found your calling.
I think so.
It's a dedication.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Yes.
It's good.
And I also work as a community specialist at Volunteers of America, working with the homeless population here in Brevard County. I'm also on the reentry task force in Brevard County, as well as the opioid task force, because, like you say, the crises kind of overlap from what I see in my day-to-day work.
So. All right, and then we have Susan Kowalski. I can say your name in my sleep. It's easy.
Thank you. Yeah, Kowalski. You did great.
And I think that's because we've had a lot of people with the last name with Eski, K-I, right? And you graduated from UCF. You began working in the field of criminal justice 30 years ago. You've been a probation officer, a classification officer, and so much more. So tell us a little bit, what is actually a reentry specialist?
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show today. Reentry is when an inmate or a probationer is reintegrated back into society. Currently, I'm working with inmates coming out of the state prison, but as a probation officer, I also help them reintegrate back into the community as well. With the reentry transition specialist, I try to help them with housing, health care, employment. Employment is key for success for those that are reentering society. So that's a big push of what I do is employment, but I also push education, whether it's a GED, associates, bachelor's, or career technical education. A lot of inmates really need to invest time into their education to build their skills. Right. So, and we talk about Brevard. I've worked throughout Central Florida over the last 30 years, and we started the reentry task force here 5 years ago when I came to, I started working in Cocoa, and I kept asking about a reentry task force, and there was never a task force here. So I said, well, why don't we asked the Brevard Homeless Coalition to start. We can start a subcommittee under the Homeless Coalition. So the Brevard Reentry Task Force is a subcommittee of the Homeless Coalition, because a lot of this does overlap. So we always seek funding. Hopefully this year we'll get the funding from the state to fund a reentry portal or a one-stop shop.
Well, our governor, Ron DeSantis, has certainly surprised a lot of us. So if someone is listening from the governor's group, his friends, anyone who knows him, tell him We'd like him to sponsor some money here for this.
That's right. And even call in on the show how we can help.
Or just go and read about what the great things that Susan and the Brevard Coalition Foundation is doing, right?
Yes.
And then we have that leads right into Stanley Breeze, who is the Director of Community Services right here for Eckerd Connects. And boy, you work with a lot of groups, Stanley. Everybody is helping each other.
Yes. I think that's the way to success. Everyone not working in silos and kind of pulling together to realize that it is something that affects all spheres of life. So working with Eckerd Connects kind of led into me overseeing Brevard's Prevention Coalition several years back. And as the opioid crisis got more to the top, it's always been a crisis, in my opinion, pretty much from the onset for years back. But since it got to the top of the news cycle, I would say, we started seeing a lot more of the community push to have people be aware of what's happening. I participated in a viewing of a DEA and FBI video over in Orange County for their drug-free office, and it led me to say, well, in Brevard, we need to form our own task force. So I am head of Brevard Prevention Coalition, but I also helped get the Brevard Opioid Abuse Task Force up and going, which I'm happy to see so much participation in. You've heard Angela talk all about it, as well as Susan, and it has just become a passion project. I had personal experience with it through family members and friends. My best friend died of an opioid overdose, actually mixed with a few other things, at the age of 25. My younger brother trying to steal pills from a pharmacy based on another sophisticated criminal, trying to get him to help him keep that going in the community, is in prison now. He's paralyzed from the waist down from being shot by police who were trying to apprehend him in Palm Bay when he was trying to flee the scene. So all of it kind of came up. I thought I knew about substance abuse before. I was already working with Eckerd with their substance abuse programming. But then when it hits home personally, it's just something that, right. You know.
That's when you double up your efforts, yeah. Right? And you say, wow, I need to get more involved. Like, you got to make more time.
Absolutely.
Like, 24 hours sometimes is not enough. For those of us that are activists, we want more, right? And some of the great things about the Brevard Homeless Coalition is I like that to provide and promote education, bring awareness, to try to end homelessness for the families, for youth and children. And yes, they're now with the opioid crisis. Everyone is focusing on that as well. So Angela, tell us a little bit about what are you doing in with your expertise to help with the Brevard Homeless Coalition.
Well, I work on what's called a challenge grant. What I do the majority of the day, if you can say there's any one thing that I do, there's always a lot of crises anytime you work in social services, especially with the homeless population. But I travel from MIMS to MICO. The grant covers outreach. And so if I get a call, which I just did actually while I was waiting when I first got here, about a homeless camp where there are individuals or families, and they are all over Brevard County, I, through my grant, am able to go out and connect with these individuals and start getting some basic information and do some basic casework and connect with one of the other 15 or so agencies that belong to the Brevard Homeless Coalition. Because different ones, like if maybe somebody has substance abuse, maybe this is a woman with children, maybe it's a domestic violence. There are so many subgroups. Maybe it's a men with a substance abuse. So there are different agencies that have different funding streams. And so it's my goal, once I connect with somebody, to connect them with another agency that's part of the coalition to get whatever services that we can, because we always need more here in Brevard County.
And that's why Eckerd Connects comes in handy, Stanley, because you know, one of the main things about people who are down on their luck, so to speak, in lay terms, hooked on drugs, can't find a job, they're homeless, living in a car, is to develop a trust and a relationship with those people. And how does one develop that trust and that relationship to where the homeless or the person in need respects and is able to come out of that shell and say, yes, I'm going to put my hand out and let this person help me?
Absolutely. Well, first, what we try to do, so one of our programs is a housing program, it's called the Brevard Family Support Services. help individuals, either whether they need case management or maybe just one-time assistance. Everyone's at different levels when it comes to homelessness as well as substance use disorder. So one thing is just not being judgmental and being client-centered with it. What do they need? Client-focused, letting them be able to share with you instead of trying to impose upon them maybe a list of rules or procedures or processes. A lot of times that goes the opposite direction that you want it to go. So by having that client-focused service, you're able to really buy that trust because they can really truly see that you're there to not necessarily, I'm going to change your life, yeah. make it better, but show them how they can actually do that through the resources that you may be able to offer them. So having a client-driven program is very important when it comes to that.
Right. And that's where Susan comes in handy because the word reentry, it means somebody's trying to get back in, right? But not always is society able to do that. Because again, it goes back to judgmental feelings from other people towards others, right? How can we help you to do a better job than you're doing now by bringing the awareness and the education to our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends? What exactly does reentry mean?
Well, reentry means, again, that we're welcoming them back into society. We want to prepare inmates or probationers to be law-abiding, tax-paying citizens, but we also need to educate and prepare the community for when they come out. I think so often, right now we have about 900 inmates that come out of the state prison back to Brevard County. We're about number 10 on the list of 67 counties, so we're one of the top counties for releases. What I've noticed over the last 5 years with the task force is the community really wants to help. Unfortunately, as a task force, we need to get out there more, and I think this is a starting point, is to make the community aware of how they can help and what is going on. So our first step is to educate, awareness, and as Stanley said, we need to break down the silos, work together, and then, of course, following HIPAA and privacy laws, is we need to start sharing information better. Our clients overlap, so we need to work together. We need to use resources more effectively and efficiently, and again, get the word out for the positive things that we're doing. So often when it comes to criminal justice, we only hear negative, but there's a lot of positives. I know many a times Angela, she'll talk to me about different success stories and those that are coming back from state prison or county jail. So, if we got stories like that out to the community, that they would see that, yes, people can change. Right, and we do have those stories. So one of our first steps is, again, now getting the word out about the task force and getting the community ready.
And Angela, so what are some of the things that someone coming out of prison, an inmate who's been released, saved his time, and by all rights, we want their rights to be restored, to vote, to get a job, go back to school, be reunited with family. When someone comes out like that, what are some of the things that they're looking for? I mean, you have to have a job. You have to have a home. You have to have some sort of education so you could find a job. What else should we be looking for to help? Can we do?
Well, us as a society, I think, is if this person is coming back to try to help that he is or she has paid their debt to society. And we always hear about recidivism, the large recidivism rate. What is it, 75%? Or it's usually very high. And people who are homeless, just imagine it even higher. But it's important for us as a community, whatever resources that are out there, to give people a chance. I was thinking, as you and Susan were just talking this last question, I had somebody that came in. He was released from prison back in December. He struggled with opioid addiction, and so he's been homeless for the past couple of months. And he was so passionate and committed to wanting to work and to wanting to do the right thing. But as time went on, and his camp, he was living in the woods, his camp would get flooded and everything he had would get lost, and problems with transportation because he doesn't have a vehicle or even a license. So after the months began to go on, and he just couldn't seem to get a foothold because primarily of the homelessness. It's difficult to maintain steady employment when you're living in the woods.
Right.
And so then there was the fear, the very real fear, and I'm so glad that he reached out, of relapse. But fortunately, we were able to come together as a coalition, and we were able to, along with his efforts as well, he didn't give up hope. And he wanted a big piece of it is wanting it yourself, but also the coalition and other agencies. We came together and were able to help him help himself, because right. definitely that's important, to give them a pathway to succeed. But he can't do it alone, or she can't do it alone. We have, as a society, give them options and opportunities as well.
Right. And Ellen and I have done so many shows about people who commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be something when people are in that situation where it's just, they're desperate. That happens as well. Right. Absolutely. And so, Stanley, we've talked on the show about that before with yes. you, the hopelessness of the situation when people don't get that second chance. So talk a little bit about that as well.
And so that's why it's so important to make sure people understand their options, but also to remove the stigma surrounding all of it. Substance use, homelessness. So often people equate it with a moral failing, when in actuality, a lot of things just happen in life where people end up in those situations. People die by suicide, and so we started changing that terminology as well. So often we do say, like, commit suicide.
Right.
Often they die by suicide. It could be accidental. It also takes the negative connotation away from it by saying it's something they're necessarily doing to themselves because they have some sort of moral failing. Same thing with opioid use. 80% of the people, that's an interesting statistic, that have died because of heroin overdose. It started from legitimate usage. That's a statistic from last year in the United States. So this is what we were talking about earlier as well. Legitimate pain management has led to using other things when they can't get that prescription filled, right. And a dependency on it. So I think that's where it kind of starts, Sita, is just
yes.
removing that stigmatized
and
thought.
And it's people that maybe had never been exposed to that before mm-hmm. and don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with it. So their next step is well, I do have that failure, I do have that defect, so I shouldn't be worthy of living, where that's so wrong. Right. So
and well, a lot of this population, if they didn't have addiction issues in the past and now it's more difficult to get the mm-hmm. opioid painkillers, oftentimes these people are not the type that would go and score heroin on the street. Mm-hmm. And so those are the ones that we really are seeing at least passively suicidal, or you know, they're not going to do without that medication. They can't imagine a life without that medication, and so those are the ones that we're seeing.
Or they don't see themselves.
Suicide.
Yeah, or they don't see that recovery is even an option get there.
Well, their self-confidence is already so low,
and then they come out and self-esteem.
Yeah, they can't cope. And Susan, I wanted to ask you. So when someone comes out of prison, and we're trying to reintegrate them back into society, right? We're looking at things like affordable housing and economic security. We want to improve their health and stability. Well, we have a difficult time as it is with just regular people mm-hmm. with affordable housing and health insurance and finding a good job. And Lord knows a lot of people working 40 hours a week still can't pay their bills because they're not paid a decent wage. How do we help those people who are coming out now to compete? Because there's so many already out there that don't have affordable housing. They might be coming back to a situation where their wife and children, or their mom, their sisters, their family members are also struggling. Because this seems to me, the whole family has to be, we have to heal the whole family at this point. Everyone needs help. So how do we, you know, I mean, society as a whole, we're failing not just the people that are coming out of prison to get back into this community, but also their families who are not doing well enough to even help that person coming out.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And I just want to give you a quick statistic when it comes to overdoses. It was a study out of Washington State. The risk of death from all drug overdoses within the first 2 weeks after release from prison was 129 times higher than those of other state residents. So anybody coming out of prison, of course, this is out of Washington State, is a greater chance of dying from an overdose those first 2 weeks, 129% higher.
And why is that? Because you would think if someone is going to be released, that I'm assuming that our state have enough money to have a meeting, some sort of a planning with the family or wherever this person is going to be released. Do we have such a thing where people, Stanley, do we have such a thing where, you know, like if somebody's coming out of the hospital, you have a social worker that sits down with the family and talks about diabetes and obesity and hypertension and drug overdose and the medication and side effects. We sit down and we have a team, a care plan team. This person is up for discharge and this is what's going to happen. Well, a human being who is in prison is still a human being coming out into this community. Do they have such a thing, Stanley, where they sit down and they say, okay, Mr. So-and-so committed a crime, he's paid his time, and now we need to help him with this, 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 and that. Do they have such a thing?
So part of, and this is part of the great thing about Susan's efforts with the reentry task force, is to increase the resources for that, because that's the answer, you know, resources. The prisons, Brevard County Jail, they do have resources that they give the people that are being discharged. But what we're trying to do right now is try to build that up.
Yes.
Because there's but so much that you could do with a limited workforce. And there's different types of inmates that are being released. Not everybody necessarily will gravitate to say, yes, I need this help. You can't make them take the help as well. So what we're trying to do as part of the Opioid Task Force, the Criminal Justice Subcommittee, is to add a person in there. It's a peer recovery support specialist to assist with what the jail already has set up in their programming. So that person will have that link and that live connection to continue on their recovery efforts when they get discharged.
Yeah, because we just saw on Facebook, I think so many people shared it, where Kim Kardashian was going to pay for a man who was released from prison and couldn't find housing. And she was going to pay for 3 years of rent for him, because everyone read his story. He came out of prison and he couldn't find anywhere to rent. So we're seeing that in Brevard as well, correct? Anybody yes. could take this question where, there's not affordable housing for regular people, much less for people coming out of prison. What do we do with all these people that don't have affordable housing? Because in order to survive, you have to have food, water, and shelter, correct? And a supportive community and family. Mm-hmm. So what are we doing about the people that can't find a place to live?
Well, there are things on the horizon, fortunately, that at this point, we don't have as many options, I wish, as I could have to give people. Nothing is more heartbreaking than looking somebody in the eye and telling them that it's going to be at the very least weeks, if not months, before I can legitimately get them into some kind of housing. Maybe if I'm lucky, I might be able to get them into some transitional housing. However, we're looking more to connecting with different resources. The faith-based community is starting to step up. I spoke to St. Vincent de Paul back a couple of weeks ago down in Palm Bay, and people came up afterward. So there are different groups that are stepping up to the plate, as well as vouchers and other programs that are out there. And so we're working harder all the time.
Yeah. Susan, do you find that that's an issue with finding lodging for when they get out of prison?
Oh, exactly. You have a convicted felon, and many applications for apartments or renting a home, they want to know, do you have a felony in your background? Let's look at your credit history. Is your credit history up to where it should be? Or do you have any evictions on your record? So felons, returning citizens is how we term it. Returning citizens coming out, they've got a lot of obstacles to overcome. So right. Housing is huge because of that.
Well, and I think the second half of the show, we're going to try to focus on the substance abuse part of it, the opioid crisis, what's going on with with the felons when they come in. Not just felons, but people in general, too.
Sure.
There's so many people that they don't have the right resources.
They're still having trouble. They just haven't gotten caught anything. So, still a lot of people out there.
Well, there's a stigma, too. There's stigma attached to people who unfortunately cannot help themselves. We have to be there to help them, right?
That's right.
And give them the education and make them aware of what's going on. So I think we should talk about that the second part of the show.
So stay tuned. We're going to listen to our sponsors real quickly, and we'll be right back with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Portions of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. Portions of Sita and Friends is brought to you by Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture Store inside the Merritt Square Mall at the Sears Wing. Save big on furniture working with a flexible family-owned store with all the brands you love, from Ashley, Serta, Coaster, Enso, and more. Brand new, warranties as well, and delivery and haul-away available at a fraction of the cost of most stores and delivered in 7 to 10 days. Free, no credit checking and financing, and free interior design. The owner, Scott Palmer, has been in the mattress and furniture business for over 30 years, and Cloud9 has been serving Central Florida for 7 years now. Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture Store, available at 321-459-2473. Again, call them 321-459-2473 or visit them on the web at cloud9.com. DixieCrossroadsFurniture.com. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000, 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at DixieCrossroads.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are doing a show today about all the social ills of society, actually, which is the truth. Homelessness, the opioid crisis, people who need jobs. I mean, whatever is going on in our community, we're here, okay? And Ellen Little is here. I'm not sure what you're doing, Miss Ellen.
I said, say your name. Say the show name.
Oh, my name. Everybody knows my name. I thought they knew my name. It's Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. I'm just excited about the show.
I know you are.
These are things that I talk about all the time with people that I see, people on Facebook. Our friend Stanley Breeze is here. I'm from Eckerd Connects. We also have Susan Kowalski, who's here with us. And we also have Angela Brazil is here with us. You know, we all talk about the opioid crisis, and we want to know what we can do for those who are suffering here in the United States, and how do we remove that stigma and that shame. We hear about it on the news. We hear that it's destroying lives. It's causing deaths every day. And there's some things that we all can do right here in the United States and around the world to help with this opioid epidemic. It is a public health emergency as well. Better addiction prevention, better overdose reversing drugs, better data, better pain management, better research. And I say one more thing to that, be more supportive. Mm-hmm. So let's start with that. I'm going to start with Susan.
Okay.
You tell us a little bit, how can we be more supportive in the with the opioid crisis and what's going on right now?
I think a couple things. First thing that I think of when it comes to the criminal justice system is to as we were talking before, to make it more treatment-oriented. You know, locking up an addict and not giving them the opportunity to go to treatment is not going to help them. When I gave the statistic about overdose, and you say, well, why is it so high? Well, their lack of treatment, when they get out, their tolerance is lower. The drugs may not be the same as what it was when they went in 10 years ago. So there's a lot of factors to it. So to be more supportive is to make sure that we are more treatment-oriented and not so punitive when it comes to things like that when somebody is an addict. What I'd like to see with the Brevard Reentry Portal is we have money set aside, if we do get the state money, that would pay for treatment. Many of the people that we see in the criminal justice system don't qualify for Medicaid, and without Medicaid expansion, hopefully, you say, what can we do? Hopefully, maybe the legislature, there'll be some kind of exemptions, maybe for substance abuse misuse. Many of the returning citizens need treatment, and that's the biggest way to support is with treatment, that we have it available to them if they can't afford it, and give them that support they need. We were talked earlier with Angela, and she gave the success story that she has, even recently. She was that rapid response team. We know the first 2 weeks is critical. She kept in touch with this returning citizen definitely for those first 2 weeks, if not longer. And she's the one who kept him, you know, going on that positive path.
Well, you got to give him that hope.
Sure.
That somebody cares. Well, you know, we all watched in last year, November, we saw where the felons got their right restored to vote. But I always say to my friends that we want people to vote. But at the same time, before you get to that voting box, you have to have a job. You have to have health care. You have to have a safe place to live. You have to have people that believe in you. You need a driver's license. How are you going to get from point A to point B if you don't have all those things lined up? So it's great to say, rah, 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 people have their rights to vote. But, and even voting, it takes time, and it also, there's a thought process behind that. If you're not doing well in life, things are not going your way, you don't have a job, you can't even pay your bills, you have nowhere to even eat a meal, how are you going to even think about voting for someone to put them in office? So it's not just to be rah, 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 people are going to be voting again. Think about these citizens that are coming back. We want them to be part of our society as well, correct?
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because even we all complain that people who are alive and well and working and taking care of their families, they're not voting. Much less for these guys who just came out of prison. Mm-hmm. And I see Stanley shaking his head.
Yeah, I'm just agreeing with you. And when it comes to this issue, I think that sometimes they need to take politics out of it.
Yes.
This is the community level. It's not. Mm-hmm. So politics can be divisive. People feel like they have to go one extreme or the other. And so what I'm liking it that we're seeing a lot of community level initiatives start. Central Florida Cares and Department of Children and Families are putting more funding and programming through to assist in this area. I know with EchoConnects, we're doing some school prevention efforts to help parents understand how to identify these signs in their children, how to identify if there's substances maybe hidden in their bedrooms.
Yeah.
We're doing that kind of thing. Letting people know about medicated-assisted treatment. It's not one size fit all
for
people
right.
with opioids, but you need to let everyone make their choice of what they want to use in order to stave off from addiction. But make sure that if you're going to use medicated assisted treatment, that counseling is included as well.
Right. And so what do you think are some of the major misconceptions concerning opioids in our country, Angela?
Well, I think kind of tying on to what Susan and Stanley were saying, about the community and the things that are so important. The misconception, I think, in the past used to be that, oh, those people are certain kinds of people.
Right, the us versus them.
Right.
Right.
And now I believe, at least in what I have seen, because I have had parents come up to me from all walks of life with their, you know, about their adult children. And now there are so many cross-sections of people that are addicted. It's mothers, grandfathers, grandmothers, police officers, there are, you know, nurses, and there's every walk of life. So in the past, if there was a thought that those people, quote unquote, are addicts, now I think that misconception has been blown wide apart. I think that we see that more and more. And if nothing else, that hopefully will open up the doors to treatment, because people can say, in all walks of life, and including powerful positions, I had a relative, my best friend, my loved one, suffered from this. And in the past, maybe it was something that wouldn't be talked about as much, but there are, you would be hard-pressed to find somebody that hadn't been affected by opioid addiction. So I think now that is one of the biggest things, that it couldn't happen to me or not in my family, not anymore.
Right.
What I've seen.
Right, and Susan, we've seen where things are not getting better, even though laws around the country have gotten stricter regarding opioids. Why is it not getting better? Where are we failing people as a society?
I think it all goes back to, again, we want prevention and intervention. I think it's great what EchoConnects is doing when it comes to prevention. I think on the adult side, our interventions, I think, again, a heavier focus on treatment. You saw last year in the budget, you know, they cut programming for substance abuse and mental health on the prison side to deal with the hepatitis C epidemic. So, you know, you start cutting funding for treatment and programs and reentry, of course, it's going to make a difference. So, again, we can't incarcerate ourselves out of this problem.
Right. Yeah, and almost it's like, you know, we all see what's happening with public schools. And I've always been one of those people that says, if you want to fix public schools, you have to fix the communities surrounding the public school. It's not enough to say, give a teacher more in wages or class size reduction or fix the infrastructure of the school. Look around and see who's living around this school. Because if you look at the communities, you would see where people need help. You would see that people need better jobs with better pay. You would see that maybe people don't have health insurance. If you see fellows loitering around on a corner in front of a shop and they're sleeping there, they're homeless. You can see what's going on in a community if you're elected official, if you're running for office or whatever it is, or you're head of an agency. If you drive around the community, it doesn't take a brain surgeon or a scientist to figure out. It's not just about words, it's about action, right? And I see Stanley, you're shaking your head. We've always talked about this.
Yeah.
Fix the community if you want to see changes.
It is, and kind of removing some of personal bias from it, because so many people do have that. it goes back to stigma, like we've been saying earlier. So let's say, for instance, you're a person's faith-based and you do have that faith. You know, God's going to fix this. God is going to take care of this. That is very, very good. There's nothing wrong with those feelings, obviously. That's accurate for your belief. But you also have to remember that you can still be a good tenant of the world right now, because that's part of your belief system as well, to take care of people and give them the resources they need. Parents also need to be aware in their community that, for instance, using Narcan, getting Narcan, which we all know it's naloxone, but that's the brand name for it, Narcan, to help people who are experiencing perhaps an overdose right in front of you. This is something that parents might want to consider. They don't know if they might come home one day and Susie or Jimmy, their friend, might have come over after school experimenting with something they don't understand as far as a drug is concerned. Maybe it's laced with fentanyl or something stronger, and they might walk up. We've seen this. They might walk into a situation where a child is about to die of an overdose. So being prepared and removing those preconceptions that this is only a poor problem, this is only the people you see on the street problem.
Right, and you do know that people think you're encouraging the use of drugs when you have the Narcan available, which, I mean, as a nurse, I can't see why people would say that, because it's better to save a life than lose a life, correct?
Absolutely.
We had Luis Garcia on the show. We talked about that stigma as well. I see you're shaking your head, Angela. Go ahead, take that one.
I did the training with Luis, and he's very passionate, and it's wonderful what he's done, not only for here in Brevard County, but going throughout the country. And like you, we were talking beforehand about how some people, I've heard this conversation, I know Stanley, we were talking about it, how the feeling is, well, if we give this Narcan out, that'll just encourage people to go out and party more. And I just don't see that as a substance abuse counselor. I've never seen an addict that wants to go through any kind of withdrawal. In fact, most of them will go out of their way to avoid withdrawal at all costs. So Narcan is something that is very valuable, I would think, in every addict's home, if you could.
Right.
For family members, loved ones, learn about it and try to keep it around because you want to keep them alive. That's the most important thing.
I was reading from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that 42,249 people died from overdoses in 2016. 116 people died daily from opioid overdose. And I'm wondering, we spend so much time on wars. We always have money for wars and things. Why isn't this such a crisis that we have more time and energy and effort to spend into this crisis? I mean, what is it still the stigma that people are on drugs and they're dying from drugs? I have no idea.
It's both that. It's that. It's political motivations because you usually have to choose an issue for your constituency. And if it's not opioids, if it's not drugs, or if it's not strong enough, you want to go hardcore on one thing and push the money in that direction so you can add it to your resume as a politician.
Right.
So it's a lot of that. It's a very multifaceted, multi-level issue.
Right.
And
right.
So it's just, it's
so where would you say that? What do you suggest as a start then to help with the opioid crisis?
Education, awareness in the community at the community level between families and between educators.
Right. And it's also cultural because, you know, I think sometimes when you have an extended family and you have that foundation, which God knows a lot of people don't have a family, they don't even have anybody to care for them from the day they're born. The odds are stacked against them from day one, right? But there are people who have families, and when they get together for family reunions or debts or weddings or birthdays or whatever, they talk about stuff. They talk about, hey, do you have a job? Hey, are you going to college? Are you going to have a trade? And they show that they care, and others don't have that. So everything does, it's a foundation, right? But what do we do for the people that don't have that foundation, that they don't have someone, that mean aunt or that uncle who's stern to say, well, you know, before you have another child, let me see you have a better job, or did you get a raise? That's what families do to take care of each other. And here we are, the community, we're acting as a family for the people that don't have one. Mm-hmm. So how do we get more people to show more compassion and care, not judge others so frequently? Like, we see a lot that people are judged based on their zip code or where they come from. How do we get more people, Susan, to think that they're the foundation for that person?
I think, you know, when it comes to reentry, a heavy focus on mentorship or those that will be a positive influence on them. I know with a lot of inmates, I talk to them, okay, let's look at who you're hanging out with. You need to change, you know, people, places, and things. We can deal with your addictions, but you also need to change your way of thinking. You need to change the people that you're hanging out with. You need to change your environment,
your attitude.
Your attitude.
But a lot of people, when they come out of prison, the only person that they knew are the people they knew before they went in.
Exactly.
Especially if they don't have family.
Exactly. And that's the key. With the Reentry Task Force, if we're funded this year for the Reentry Portal, it's so important to do the pre-release, get it ready before the release, for us to go into the prison or at least make contact, say, 90 days before the release, so they know that there's somebody out there who is going to help them before the release. Those first couple days after being released are critical. So what we do in reentry is we focus on the high-risk offenders. We do a needs and risk assessment, and we focus on those high-risk offenders. And with those high-risk offenders, they get the intensive case management. So you've got that coach. We're not referees. We're coaches. We're a mentor. Just as with Angela did, she was, you know, a coach to the man that came out, the returning citizen from prison. So that's what we can do as a system. And, of course, as a community, the faith community is a huge part of reentry as well.
Well, it always goes back to those five things, Ellen. Faith, food, family, friendship, and a little finances. Always. If you have those.
Forgiveness.
And forgiveness. We added forgiveness. And that's a big thing, Stanley. We've talked about second chances. Mm-hmm. And why we have to forgive people. And oftentimes we say it, but the society does not forgive. People need to actually, once you've paid your time and you come out and you're here, you should be able to be part of the family again. I know, like in Trinidad, they say, oh, he break a jail. That's it. That's the end of it. That's the end. You don't hear about that person anymore, right? Am I correct?
No, you're right.
They go
right.
Back to dancing, calypso, singing, cooking, everything. There is no stigma.
No, it's true. And so that points it back to culture, right? You know, and what are we as a society, you know, what do we want to be known as? What's our large, I guess, picture looking at us as a whole? And so many times it's, oh, that person has done this. That's what they are. You are identified by the worst thing you've done, especially if it's something that they can leverage against you to put themselves up. And so it goes to that level.
Right. Well, because, you know, the prison system should be about reforms. It should be about reforms so that when you come out, you've paid your debt to society and you're trying to be a better person than you were when you went in.
It's called corrections, right?
Right. Right. But here's the thing, but correction, we were saying that earlier, that the word correction, some people don't actually say the word properly or know what it means. Corrections officer or Department of Corrections.
But it goes to, I think, society in a bigger context, that there's a saying that you judge a society by how they treat their most vulnerable people in it. And
we're bullies.
Yes. And we want to think that
we judge.
Because, yes, somebody did something bad in their past. Well, for one, if they're getting out, it obviously was judged that it was not so bad that they can't be re-released back into society. Then it needs to be something that, you know, but for the grace of God, there go I. Mm-hmm. You know, have we all made mistakes? And they are, at this point, vulnerable. And they are in need of society's help.
Right. So Stanley, I'm going to ask a question, and everyone will give us the answer in like 30, maybe in a minute or two. We still have like 10 minutes. Yeah. So what should a family member do if they suspect that someone is addicted, whether in the general population or coming back out of prison or paid their time to society? What should we do?
So first, it's educating yourself. I think before you know how to help, you need to educate yourself. A lot of times we think we know how to handle that situation, but we haven't truly done the homework to figure out how it impacts the family and how we can actually be of a help to that individual. And then second, seeking the resources. I'm a big believer of that. I don't know everything. I'm involved with the Opioid Task Force, but there's people with counseling background. There are people with the correction side background that know exactly what I might need to help my family have those resources to go forward. But I think most of all, underneath all of that, is approaching it from a non-judgmental standpoint and realizing that you're dealing with someone who may not be thinking, who more likely is not thinking as logically as you are about their situation, and realizing it's going to be a rough road and preparing yourself for that.
And Susan, same question. You're with the Brevard Reentry Task Force, and I bet you see a lot of that as well.
Exactly. The first thing is to build that trust. And, you know, you can't help somebody who doesn't want the help. But through just talking with them, that motivational interviewing skills that you have, is to get them to see, you know, that they can better themselves. They can have a better life. There is hope. So it's just building that trust. And, you know, when they're ready to change, we will be there. So again, it's just you know, building the relationship, building that trust with them, and letting them know the resources that are out there. We want to give them the most current information, you know, who is eligible, who you can call. I always promote, of course, AA or NA. Get in there, work the program, get a sponsor. But there are people out there wanting to help you if you want the help.
And Angela, you had developed specific professional goals for people. And one of them was that you've said that clients always do well in a safe, controlled environment. But when they return to their old life with the triggers, something happens. Mm-hmm. So tell us, expand on that a little bit.
Well, I'm a big believer in recovery and individualized recovery plans. Because like my illustrious cohorts were saying, everybody can do well in rehab, or most everybody does, but people's needs are individual and specific, and it isn't a one-size-fits-all issue. However, it is a medical issue, a life-threatening medical issue, and so finding out exactly what this person needs, a lot of times we have people that have co-occurring mental health issues, so dealing with that's very important if we want to see them have success with their recovery, with their sobriety. Also, I'm a big believer in Al-Anon or family programs, because again, it's important for you to have that
it's
support.
Like group therapy too, when you have the whole family,
and it's called detach with love, that you can still love this person without getting so sucked into the drama and the chaos that surrounds
and the codependency.
Addiction. Right. Absolutely. Well, and that's important, because the family members are it becomes a sick family.
Yeah.
And it's important for everybody to get treatment.
Well, you know,
recovery is important, and long term too.
I saw in Toronto, I have a friend who's a monk in Toronto, and they're using yoga and meditation from day one when people are admitted into, when they go into prison, right? And I almost said admitted into the hospital. That's the nurse coming out of me. But the thing is, I find not just for the people who are trying to be integrated back into society, but for regular population, for just people in general, I think if we all take the time to think about what we're doing, change our attitude, change the message from our brain, don't let negativity rent space in your head. You know, it does make a difference. So, it's like from a child, you have to start that if something is going to happen that's going to cause you to do things that are not right and you know it, then you go to an adult and they can help you with that. Or you go to somebody in your church or your clergy or whatever. But how do we get more people to actually stick to that kind of a lifestyle where it's meditation, it's yoga, it's taking a walk, it's thinking positive? Because apparently those are things that are free. Right. And it could be cultural as well, but why aren't we doing more of that to where people can't cope and they have to go to drugs?
Well, most recovery programs and a lot of the rehabs are actually going toward a mind, body, spiritual, like a three-pronged approach with nutrition, with re-educating about proper sleep and proper exercise, and a totally holistic program, because that's where the real results are seen, that they can continue this once they left. Not that 12-step meetings aren't important, because that is an important piece of the puzzle, but it's a larger integrative lifestyle change that has to be made.
Right, and we've all seen those stories on Facebook and social media and Twitter. People will tweet out how well they feel because they've changed their lifestyle, they've changed their environment, they've changed the company they keep. I think that's a key too, is... And Stanley always shakes his head for that one, because show me your friends.
Skills.
Well, yeah, show me your friends and I'll show you who you are. And
that was my mom's favorite saying.
Remember that? We're all seeing I was listening after we had the New Zealand shooting, the murderer, I should say, who killed all these people, the terrorists. They were saying that he was indoctrinated online by peer groups that thought the way he thought. He did things with people of his own kind. And so it's not just for drug addiction and homeless people and people going into, it's regular people that are hanging with fellas on doing things that are wrong.
Well, that gentleman just chose violence over drugs.
But again, it's a company he kept. He kept the company of people that did those things. So what I'm saying, Stanley, is, you know, if someone gets hooked on drugs, but show me their friends.
Absolutely. You know, who are you associating with? I mean, I go back to my younger brother. That's how he got involved. Same thing with my best friend. He ended up associating with people from rehab who were still struggling, and they ended up, Angela shaking her head, this happens a lot, they relapsed together, and it ended up being the end of his life. So it's truly, but also instilling people with that message,
Yes.
Of how to choose the right people, because once again, they're coming out of a situation where they may not be thinking clearly or logically about that and going back to what they're used to.
Right. I know you want to add to that. Go right ahead.
Well, I always think about, I tell inmates when they're releasing, you know, changing who you're hanging out with and your peers, but they always say, well, I'm going to just stay on my own. Well, no, we don't want you just to be isolated. We want you to seek out, you know, make
like-minded people, but in a good way. Yes. Well, even if you like the environment, there are people who care about the environment. You could get a group that likes to take care of the sea.
Exactly.
Or beach cleanup. Or if you want to take care of trees, there's something for nature lovers. But all those people who are in those kind of groups, you can befriend them. You could change the course of your own life by changing the actions in which you choose to enable yourself in.
There's even peer recovery specialists, certified peer recovery specialists, individuals who have had an issue with addiction in the past that have been at least, say, in recovery for about 2 years or more. There's certifications they can go for. And sometimes that helps because there's people who understand what you're coming out of. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get more of that put into these different programs. It's like the prisons and hospitals to help people that are being released back to society.
I know this is when Ellen comes in handy here for the information and the websites, and because, you know, it's a multifaceted thing, right? It's not just one size fit all. A little bit of everything, a little bit of yoga, a little bit of meditation, a little bit of changing your friends and family foundation, helping people to get a job. Understanding is not only about saying it, but doing it, given the having the action and the resources as well. And then partnering up with people in the community that are like-minded and want to do the same thing for others.
So let's go around the table here and talk. Give your website and some contact information as a resource for those that are listening that might have somebody that is in their family or possibly themselves that might be looking for some resources. What's your best resource? Not just your own website, of course, but another great resource that you'd like to pass on to somebody. Stanley, you want to start?
Absolutely. So for EchoConnect's programs on helping individuals with housing, as well as education and prevention, we can go to www.eckerd.org, E-C-K-E-R-D.org, as well as for our Brevard Prevention Coalition, brevardprevention.org for prevention resources.
Excellent. And Susan?
Well, the Brevard Homeless Coalition is who we're under, so I would refer people who need assistance to the Brevard Homeless Coalition website. I'm sorry, I don't have that in
front
of me.
That's okay. We have 30 seconds, and this is where Angela could just tell us her website.
I also am here under the Brevard Homeless Coalition umbrella today, even though I do work for Volunteers of America. Mm-hmm. I can give you that, www.voaflorida, that's all one word, .org.
What are you saying, that food fixes everything? A big potluck?
That's probably true. But as always, if you contact CETA or I through the website, through CETAMediaInc.com, or if you'd like to contact CETA by email, it's CETAMedia@AOL.com.
And I'm going by a new name. It's called Hindu for Peace.
There you go.
I mean peace. Like, the whole world need to be more loving, more compassionate, more understanding, non-judgmental, and I think we could fix things.
Excellent. So all of our shows are on demand, and certainly you can download them from our website, as you can from the 1510 WWBC website. And we've just enjoyed being with all of you today. Thank you so much for all of your information and all the resources that you provided us today. And we'll be back next week for another great edition of Viewpoint with CETA and Friends.
This is the Christian Voice of Brevard on WWBC 1510 AM.
And you're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Merritt Island, Melbourne, Titusville, and the Beaches, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Rockledge, Merritt Island, FM 94.7. You're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Melbourne, Titusville.